versus Towers Boat Club, 2012 SC 391. Are both parties ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
A couple of housekeeping matters. First, argument is set for an hour. The petitioner will have to keep track of your time. It's a half hour apiece. excuse me. When you argue, please tell us who you are and who you represent. And we do use, some of us at least, do use iPads. So we have our notes and our briefs and parts of the record. And we have links to Westlaw. So we're not emailing and surface, not emailing and surfing. So with that, we're going. Let's go. Hear from the petitioner.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I may raise this, it's not so much higher challenge, but visual acuity is an issue. Good morning, may it please the court. I'm John Kupis. My registration number is 925, and I represent SW and his parents. His father, David Wachter, being present in the courtroom today. This is another matter involving statutory construction for this court to decide how things are and should be in terms of the interpretation of a given statute, this one being the Colorado Premises Liability Act, and the issue being the scope of applicability of the attractive nuisance doctrine under that act, and is phrased by this court in taking cert, issuing its order. The issue is phrased as whether under the Premises Liability Statute, CRS 13-21-115, the attractive nuisance doctrine and its protections are applicable only to trespassing children, but not to children on premises as licensees or invitees. This case, as the court knows, arises out of an incident in 2008 at a social gathering of Blue Paw Tower Boat Club, which is the respondent in this matter, the defendant, a defendant below. And what happened was that there were inflatables being used, having been rented by Tower Boat Club for use by young children at the event, which happened at a reservoir up by Wellington. And a blast of wind came along, forced what was called a bungee run, which is a thing where the kids run on them, trying to go as far as they can, attached by a bungee rope. There were three or four of them on the inflatable. It was blown into the air like a kite, went to a considerable distance, variously estimated. The children were dumped out of the instrumentality, and SW, called the Court of Appeals, incurred a serious brain injury. Other children were incurred lesser injury. So the issue really here is that on the facts of this case, and it goes beyond that, I'll get to that in a second. On the facts of this case, is there any good societal policy or legal reason why a juvenile, in this case 11 years old at the time this happened, who is on premises with permission and invitation, essentially in this case of Tower Boat Club and its members, should have lesser protections under the attractive nuisance doctrine than does a young child that, for instance, let's just say, lived in a neighborhood, was not invited to the party, but trespassed on the party and essentially sneaked on to the instrumentality, the so-called bungee run. That individual would be a trespasser under the holding below, the opinion below, and would have the protections of the attractive nuisance doctrine. But the person in SW's position would not. Inflatables are in widespread use in various contexts, from commercial establishments, the church socials, to backyard birthday parties, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's an important safety issue just with respect to those instrumentalities. But it's also the issue we're dealing with here, a much broader than that and involves other things. I mean, for instance, and you can think of it in examples as your imagination will allow, but for instance, somebody who is a paying guest, whose folks have paid for him to ride on a carnival or a roller coaster or a Ferris wheel at a carnival or an amusement park, should that person have lesser protections under the attractive nuisance doctrine in the event that the instrumentality is poorly maintained than does a person who is a kid that sneaks onto the premises of a carnival and sneaks onto the ride, doesn't pay? That kid is going to have protections as a trespasser, which the licensee or invitee would not. You can think of a million other examples. The baseball pitching machine shoots of somebody whose folks have paid for him to be in a baseball area where they've got a wonky pitching machine which throws at the head instead of the plate. Should that paying customer, thereby permission with consent of landlord, have lesser protection than somebody who, again, trespassed in the middle of the night, put the machine into operation, and it whacked them in the head? We think, and our position is, that there is no good societal, social policy, or legal reason why those protections should exist for the trespasser, but not for the licensee or invitee, and that indeed the construction put on the statute by the opinion below really collides with and conflicts with a number of established set of Colorado legal principles. The first of those, let me just say that our position, as we see it, is entirely consistent and congruent with the mainstream of thought about the attractive nuisance doctrine in this country. It is consistent with the statement in Amgur, which we cite only because of its generality, recognizing it may be the popular mechanic of jurisprudence, but it does say there that the courts generally have recognized that the attractive nuisance doctrine should apply equally to children, regardless of status as invitee, licensee, or trespasser. That is also a position of the restatement, which has critically been in place since, in our view, just as a guideline since 1965. And it's 339 provides the general rules about what's applicable to the duty to a trespasser. And then 343B expressly says that those same protections are available to children who are licensees and invitees. And in similar fashion, this court's Committee on Civil Jury Instructions, since really the inception of the statute, Premises Liability Statute, has had an instruction in place which became 12.4, and its notes and authority have said since 1989 at the latest that there is no policy reason, no good reason why the attractive nuisance doctrine protections should not be.
Well, now you're not relying on the common law, are you? I mean, aren't you relying on subsection 2?
I am, Your Honor.
It specifically preserves the doctrine of attractive nuisance.
That's correct.
And that's combined with the language about activities conducted on the landowner's premises, right?
It is. Right. I mean, it's all of a piece in the statute.
That's sort of preamble to the distinctions among trespasser or licensee and invitee.
Well, the statute, Your Honor, says, as you know, Justice Hobbs says, that nothing in the statute basically shall be read or interpreted to abrogate the doctrine of attractive nuisance with respect to children under the age of 14.
Okay, so, but isn't your problem with the common law really talked about of Colorado? You can correct me if I'm wrong about this. Apply attractive nuisance to a trespassing child who is, in effect, lured onto the land by something that, compels that or invites that child to assume a very big risk of danger, and that was a common law category for applicable only to trespassers.
Well, we disagree with that, Justice Hobbs, for several reasons. One, the cases that we cited that the Court of Appeals had omitted from its analysis in that regard, of Public Service Company v. Petty and Pueblo Street Railway Company v. Sherman, involved the application of the so-called turntable doctrine, which became the attractive nuisance doctrine in different terms, to children who were not trespassers. So there is a band of cases for sure, which is said in the Staley case, talk about the necessity of the instrumentality, the attraction, enticing the trespass, but otherwise you don't have the equivalent of an implied invitation. There are those, but there is no Colorado case up until the opinion of the court below, in the Court of Appeals, which says that the protections of the attractive nuisance doctrine are not available to a plaintiff because that plaintiff is a licensee or an invitee and not a trespasser. There is just no case that says that up until now.
And there's no language in the statute that would indicate, other than that general statement that you're saying is applicable to all the categories, all the status categories.
Our position is yes, that was a position too of this court's committee on civil jury instructions for the 20-year history of this statute up until the opinion below. The instruction read up until this last 2013 edition after the opinion below that an element of the thing was of the attractive nuisance doctrine was that either the person was attracted onto the premises by the instrumentality, enticed onto the trespass, or was there with the implied or express permission of the landlord.
Now, whether or not this particular bungee apparatus is or is not an attractive nuisance, would you say that's a tribal issue?
Yes, because it has a special appeal to children.
But the jury or the judge without the jury trial, whatever, is going to have to decide that, right?
I think that's correct. I mean, it's certainly not a matter of law. It is an attractive nuisance or is not.
Okay.
Counsel, can I get you to just address the statement, though, in the Nuremberg case that essentially says that the source of the doctrine, it was devised as a way to allow children who were trespassers to recover. I guess you agree with that, but that the doctrine developed to apply to invitees and licensees?
Well, I think the statement is correct, Justice Hyde, with respect to the fact that there is a band of cases which addresses this situation, and the focus of that band of cases really was not the status of the injured person, the injured client, but was the nature of the instrumentality and did it function as an enticement? Or was the person on, for instance, the premises for other reasons?
But the case uses the word trespasser. So, I mean, how do you interpret that?
Well, I think if you look at that case alone, that's one of those cases which is focusing on the instrumentality and did it entice. But if you look at the other authorities, including the Petty case, there is basis for saying that Colorado law up until the this opinion below did not preclude application of the attractive nuisance doctrine to licensees or invitees, and no Colorado case said so. No Colorado court case said so. So it's dicta, as we've tried to address in there, that to the extent these statements are made in these cases, this band of cases we're talking about, they're really not necessary to the determination of the case at issue, because all those cases involve trespassing kids, all of them. So it was not necessary to the decision for the court to say whether or not the doctrine would be applicable to licensees or invitees as well. And they didn't say that. They just said, in this particular case, it either isn't an attractive nuisance or it is, or there was not enticement or there was, those kinds of things.
How did it? I mean, the cases, as you suggest, all dealt with trespassers, and we have a statement that the source of the doctrine is trespassers. So how did it get expanded to other categories?
Well, I think what happened is that as I read the statute, once the statute was passed, obviously the Sports Committee on Civil Jury Instructions took a look and said, okay, what do we do now? And they invented 12.4, which was had a predecessor, 12.6 number, I think, the first time around after the statute was enacted. And in that, they incorporated their thinking, which shows up in their comments to the instruction, which says, while it's true that this doctrine developed initially with respect to trespassing children, there is no good reason why it shouldn't be applied to these other people. And that thinking, that really functioned to guide the application of the attractive nuisance doctrine and the premises liability statute for more than 20 years, up until the opinion of the law.
So you essentially say it was not expanded by case law, but it was expanded by the civil jury instruction?
I think fundamentally that is correct. Okay. I mean, and in that context, we all know that the civil jury instructions, the committee, are not the equivalent of this court or the court of appeals, and it's not law, and it's not corrected if it doesn't reflect prevailing law. But as this court has said, it's a hardworking, conscientious committee, and they obviously thought it did reflect prevailing law. And if you look at the broad spectrum about what does the attractive nuisance doctrine mean generally across the country and under the settled authorities, like the restatement and so forth, that's correct.
What do you, I mean, just following up on your policy reason, then, what are you getting out of the attractive nuisance doctrine?
What do we get out of the attractive nuisance doctrine?
Yeah, well, how does that apply to trespassers, invitees, and licensees?
Basically, what we get are the elements that are included in 12.4 of the instruction. Although that's changed as of this opinion. That's changed a little. Well, it's changed important. So what we get is the application of the concept of the attractive nuisance doctrine and the concept of reasonable care to kids who are on premises and whose safety is essentially disregarded by the landowner, whether they're on those premises as trespassers or licensees or invitees. I mean, the court is well aware, Gallegos versus Phipps stands for the proposition that having an inverted hierarchy of protections where a trespasser gets greater protection than a licensee or invitee is unconstitutional. It's no legitimate.
What's that standard of care? I think that's pretty significant. Is it general negligence? Is it the standard of care identified in licensee or invitee? The legislature established differing standards of care in this statute. What standard of care are you arguing for?
Reasonable care, Your Honor, and as we have briefed, that's been part of the attractive nuisance doctrine, not just in Colorado, but everywhere, that where the courts have considered. They've talked about ordinary care, reasonable care, those kinds of things.
So that's the general negligence standard, right?
It is.
Okay. And so you'd be overriding the invitee and licensee standards of care that are identified in the statute.
It is a category of reasonable care, which is different from the standards that are provided expressly in the statute for the licensees, invitees. But that's always been true with respect to the attractive nuisance doctrine. I mean,
we've got a codification here where the legislature rejected a general negligence standard where we had said that the general negligence standard should apply. The legislature came right back and established these categories.
Well, I agree with that, Justice Hobbs, in part, but not in another part, because they came right back and also said, as I said, they said in 86 and in 90, nothing in this statute is to be taken to abrogate the doctrine of the attractive nuisance doctrine with respect to children under the age of 14 years.
Now, what's the significance of the choice of 14 by the legislature?
Well, to me, the significance is simply that it shows that the legislature was not adopting whatever this the standard had been in Colorado for application of the attractive nuisance doctrine, lock, stock, and barrel, because up until the statute, the application had been for minors, would be under 18 in the early days of 21. And that obviously was changed by the legislature, so that it's only applicable to children under 14. So that tells that it stands by its own, but it also illustrates that the legislature...
So it's a specific exception to the duties of care articulated in the other categories.
Yes, it is. And it was repeated, and if you talk about the attractive nuisance doctrine, as shown in the respondents' briefing, that instruction that they included on the attractive nuisance doctrine from 1969, in the first edition of CJI, it includes a reasonable care standard as the standard of care. And that is true throughout the case law, wherever you look. They talk about ordinary care, as I said, reasonable care. It's just part of the attractive nuisance doctrine.
But what's the difference between the standard of care, reasonable care under attractive nuisance in the category standards?
Okay. Well, with respect to the licensee, it's really you have to have a condition of which the landowner knew, and if it's an invitee, it's a condition of which the reasonable landowner knew or should have known. And there are some other elements to that. But this is it's a softer or more general and broader standard, the standard of reasonable care.
So are you are you a licensee or an invitee?
We're a licensee because the statute says a social guest is a licensee.
Okay.
And otherwise, I think you're an invitee, but that's not what the statute says.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, I'm a little confused about the posture of this claim. Is it filed as a PLA claim, or is it a freestanding, separate tort? I'm struggling to understand how it was in your complaint.
It was filed as a violation, an alleged violation of the Colorado Premises Liability Statute.
Okay, so it's filed as a PLA claim, but then you're working under the exception there for the carve-out, if you will, for the attractive nuisance doctrine.
Right. In the trial court, the respondent argued, and other defendants there argued, that we had not properly pled the attractive nuisance doctrine. And our response was, well, we certainly have to. We put the whole statute of the attractive nuisance doctrine as part of it. The trial court agreed with us on that subject, and that was not appealed by anyone. So that's kind of the way that evolved. And that's really what our position has been, is that we have pled the statute by name and number. And so we pled all of its elements for purposes of notice pleading.
But you're also claiming then that the attractive nuisance doctrine incorporates or at least triggers a different standard of review than is otherwise listed under the PLA.
A different standard of care.
A different standard of care.
Because it is a fourth category, really, that is created by that statute. But it says, this is sacrosanct, this doctrine of attractive nuisance doctrine. And this statute is not to be deemed as abrogating it. And as it existed, the standard of care involved in it was reasonable.
And you're deriving that standard of care from Colorado common law?
Among other things. I mean, every place where you see the turntable cases discussed or the attractive nuisance cases discussed, they talk about the doctrine of ordinary care, reasonable care, and it's reflected as an important example in that instruction that I just mentioned. It showed up as early as 1969, where it gives the standard of care as being a breach of reasonable care.
And it's also then finally, it's also your claim that if a trespassing child is entitled to this different standard of reasonable care, the licensee should also be entitled to that reasonable standard of care because it is in fact it's a standard of care that's more favorable in that context than it would be for a licensee under the categories in the statute.
That's right, for a licensee or invitee under the 8014. It's always been a sort of special level of protection for those young people because they're not deemed to have the capacity to make the kind of decisions that older people could be to avoid the dangers, et cetera, et cetera.
Thank you.
Well, let me just follow up on that point. You were going just where I wanted to go. I'll just take one last step. I'm still not exactly clear. Let's avoid licensee because that may be a little more complicated. But with an invitee, as it's defined in the PLA,
right?
How do you envision the standard of attractive nuisance being more beneficial to you than it would be for, or let's say, to a licensee child than it would be for the...
Arguably, for the invitee, it's not going to be different. I mean, as a practical matter, it's going to be interpreted to be basically the same thing. It's like akin to the unreasonable failure to exercise reasonable care being deemed to be just failure to exercise reasonable care. For a licensee vote, which would include our client, makes quite a difference.
Because of the difference of known or reasonably should have known.
Right.
And let me just take you back one step then to our question about the way the doctrine applied before the PLA. And I appreciate your point that all of those cases that where the language about trespasser was used seemed to all involve trespassers. So one might say the court was not looking to say anything one way or the other about invitees or licensees. But if you happen to have this, you know, in your baggage right here and can let me know, given the way licensees were treated and invitees were treated before the PLA, what would the advantage have been for either of those, a child in either of those categories, to be seeking a benefit under the nuisance?
Well, not a great one, I don't think. I mean, I think you're basically dealing with before the Premises Liability Act, you're basically dealing with a generalized standard of reasonable care, with the exception that to trespassers, you know, really there was no duty of care, with the exception of the attractive nuisance doctrine.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Premises?
Yes, Mr. Schreiber.
We'll finish with that line of inquiry. So is it fair to say that, at least from your opinion, this is really a case of first impression for this court?
No question about it, in my opinion.
And then, given that we agree on that, the Court of Appeals opinion seems to say, if you read it, I'm not going to rely on this, I'm not going to rely on this, I'm not going to rely on this. It's a number of things that it finds not helpful. So my question to you is, what should we rely on? And we can't rely on, I don't think, the Colorado Jury Instruction Committee. So what should we be relying on?
Well, I think we should rely on what the concept of just what does the statute say? It just says this is to be applicable to children under 14.
Just the plain language of the statute,
right.
Which doesn't exclude or include anything.
Right. It doesn't carve out any exceptions.
And you think we don't? Do you think we don't need to go any further than that?
I don't think you need to, but I think you can easily, like with Gallegos versus Phipps.
Please.
I mean, I just don't see how you can avoid concluding that the opinion below creates the same inverted hierarchy which was condemned and declared to be unconstitutional in Gallegos versus Phipps. And then you can look at the other language of the statute, which says twice, basically, what we're doing here is trying to make very sure that trespassers don't have greater rights than licensees, and that licensees don't have greater rights than invitees. And they say that expressly. And then they talk about the attractiveness doctrine generally, although, as the court well knows, the statute twice calls out particular cases as being at issue, and if they wanted to, the legislature, as we indicated in our briefing, confine the attractiveness doctrine to the sort of narrow and very minority position that would be reflected if you took the court opinion below as to being correct, they certainly could have said so. They did not. They just talked about the attractiveness of the doctrine generally.
Okay.
So I think all those factors and some of the other principles.
Well, under your construction, we don't need to get to that parsing and differentiation, the constitutional type problem, right? I mean, you're saying it's generic, it applies to all the categories.
I am, Your Honor, yes. And, you know, about the constitutional issue, I'm reminded about the fact that there is also settled case law in this jurisdiction that if you have a choice in interpreting a statute of one way which is unconstitutional and one way which is constitutional, you construe it to be constitutional. And so that argues saying, under Gallegos v. Phipps, if you take the approach of the opinion below as unconstitutional, that's an incorrect approach. Thank you. I think I have a second or two left.
You've got 2 minutes for questions.
May May it please the court, my name is Joel Palmer, number 36459, and I'm here today for the respondent, Towers Boat Club. I think where we need to begin this analysis, and it follows up on some of the conversation we've already had, which the point to begin is the common law in Colorado regarding the attractive nuisance doctrine. And we have a number of decisions from this court about that doctrine and explaining what it means. And we talked all about those in the brief. At general common law, there was no duty to a trespasser, and it didn't matter the age of the trespasser. But the attractive nuisance doctrine came into existence to mitigate that rule in the case of, at the time, minors, people under the age of 18. And the reason was, if you had, for example, a merry-go-round on your property, something obviously attractive to children who don't possess the requisite maturity and judgment to understand that a merry-go-round, as beautiful as it looks, is a piece of potentially dangerous machinery. So what we're going to do under this doctrine is, and this language is in the cases, we're going to treat that merry-go-round being placed out in the open, unprotected by any fence, any protective device. We're going to say that's an implied invitation to that child. That child is now an invitee, constructively, and we're going to treat the child as such. We see this in a case like Heiko from 1925, which says, what we had in this case was a shack, and it had blasting caps in it. And the child trespassed on the property, but not to get to the blasting caps. The child had no idea was in the shack. The child just trespassed on the property. So in that circumstance, we're not going to treat that as an invitation to that child, because that shack, that's really nothing that the child necessarily would find irresistible. So we created this rule, and the rule, I believe, was created in this country by an 1873 case in front of the Supreme Court. It did involve what we call turntables. These were railway turntables, not unlike a merry-go-round. And as that doctrine was applied in Colorado after Heiko in 1925, again and again and again, the restriction was made about trespassing. It was only an exception to the general no-duty rule for trespassers. If you were, for example, an invitee pursuant to an express invitation, you don't need resort to the attractive nuisance doctrine. You're already protected by the standards of care that were set forth in the common law. We saw that in a case mentioned by Justice Ide, the Nuremberg case, which notes this was only a rule that was an exception to the general rule on trespassing. Now, I know we've had this debate here about, particularly in the briefs, about whether all these cases from this court, Heiker, Esquivel, Callahan, Garcia, Staley, Garrell, whether these are dicta. Well, they weren't dicta to this court when they wrote the opinion in 1950 in Nuremberg. They weren't dicta to the 1969 committee that wrote the first pattern jury instruction on attractive nuisance, which we quoted in our brief. That instruction notes that trespassing has to be an element of the event of the claim. If there's no trespassing, the doctrine isn't going to apply. And indeed, if the instrumentality that is the attractive nuisance, the alleged attractive nuisance, is not the thing that attracts the young person onto the property, the doctrine doesn't apply.
Counsel, could I just ask you a question about the Vigil versus Franklin case, which of course says that we determine that the legislature's determination was to fully occupy this field of premises liability, if you will. And as a result of that, really, we always, when we have these kinds of cases, have to start with the statute to understand what is meant. And therefore, it's not helpful because of this legislative determination to fully occupy this area of the law, to go back further than the statute. And you spent quite a bit of your brief talking about really kind of first year law school principles about why attractive nuisance came into existence. But can you explain to me why those even help us, given the extent and exhaustiveness, if you will, of the PLA?
Yeah, let me address that. And let me address it by reference to a case called Pearson from this court in 2002. Talking about this very statute. Pearson, here's a quote, "We will construe words and phrases that have acquired a technical or particular meaning, whether by legislative definition or otherwise accordingly." We have this phrase in the statute. abrogate the doctrine of attractive nuisance. Attractive nuisance isn't defined in the statute, but in Colorado common law, it has a definition. It has a definition we've seen in the cases I've mentioned, seen in the original jury instruction on this matter, seen in the, as described in the Colorado practice series on torts, which was referred to in the Vigil case and referenced to attorneys to read as an explanation of the history of premises liability law in Colorado. And so we're going to try to figure out what that term means, attractive nuisance, and what the legislature wanted, it to mean. I think a good place to start, and maybe the only relevant place to direct our attention, is to what this court has said about what the doctrine is. We've cited a case in our brief that notes that there's the doctrine that the legislature is presumed to know relevant, key that word in, relevant, judicial precedent. In fact, it was expressed a different way in a case that we cited, where this court said the legislature is presumed to know our precedents, the court referring to itself, its own decisions on a particular subject matter. So when we talk about the question you've asked, Justice Rice, this, we're subsuming this entire field. We're taking this whole thing over. We have to figure out what attractive nuisance means, and to do that, we have to go back to what this court has decided it meant in the past. And we know what it meant. It meant it was a doctrine only as an exception for trespassers. Trespassing was a prerequisite. Now, let's get to the language, other language in the statute, because I think that's where you want me to go. Now, yes. I'm going to start at Section 2. I'm going to start at Section 1.5 in the 1990 version of the statute, because that's where the legislature made it very clear what its intent and what its goals are for this statute. The first thing it said was why it passed the statute in the first place in 1986. It said that it did that, and it used the words assure, to assure that liability and the ability of a plaintiff to recover is correlated to the status as either an invitee, licensee, or trespasser. And I highlight again that word assure. That's a guarantee, it's a promise. We want to make sure that going forward in any premises liability case, we're going to key in liability to the reason why the plaintiff came onto the property. And remember, attractive nuisance at Colorado common law is all about why the plaintiff came onto the property. Why did that little boy trespass? Simply across the lot to get from point A to point B and then saw the merry-go-round? Or did he come on because he saw the merry-go-round and couldn't resist it? The next portions of Section 1.5 talk about other goals and intentions of the legislature: to foster private property rights, to foster the ability to obtain insurance in an affordable manner. And then there's another portion of 1.5 that talks about, I wouldn't necessarily call it the interpretive part of the statute, but it says that it once again wants to assure that the statute in ways applied in such a way that it's consistent with the regime that's now being set up in the later portions of the statute. So 1.5 comes first. 1.5 is our touchstone for everything else that follows in the statute, and if we have to interpret what follows, we interpret it in a fashion that fulfills the goals of 1.5. So now we move to Section 2. I wish to make a correction here. Section 2 does not say that nothing in this statute will be interpreted to abrogate the doctrine. It says nothing in Section 2 will be interpreted to abrogate the doctrine. And Section 2 also says that in any action, that's the key word, in any action involving premises liability, a landowner will be liable, quote, only, unquote, as provided in Section 3. Section 3 being the three duties of care, the definitions of the three duties for invitees, licensees, trespassers. So, and then we get to the sentence involving nothing but in this section will abrogate the doctrine of attractive nuisance without any definition being provided. How do we harmonize all this? It can be harmonized quite easily, and it can be harmonized just the way that the appellate court did it. Remember, at Colorado common law, attractive nuisance made the trespasser an invitee. It wasn't applied to every case involving a trespasser. In fact, you see in the cases that we cited, many times it wasn't applied to those children, even though they suffered grievous injury. In fact, some of them suffered death, unfortunately. But it becomes a constructive or implied invitation. Read the definition of invitee under the statute. It talks about an express or implied representation that it's okay to come onto the property. So how do we harmonize? Well, it means this. when there's a trespassing situation, and only a trespassing situation, and there's an allegation of attracting nuisance, that merry-go-round that's unprotected, that little boy just couldn't resist. If that's indeed found to be an attractive nuisance, and that was the thing that enticed the little boy on the property, and it's the thing that injured the little boy, that little boy's not a trespasser anymore. He is an invitee, and he's treated as such under the statute. And that harmonizes it completely.
Counsel, can I just stop you? Can you respond to the argument that the person in question here was licensee? And so you're bumping the trespasser, surpassing the licensee up to the invitee, but then the licensee just doesn't get the protections? I mean, how do you deal with that? What's your response to that argument that your opposing counsel is making?
Well, again, first of all, the trespasser isn't a trespasser. It's an implied invitation. Now they are an invitee, and that's noted in multiple cases we've cited. It is a constructive invitation. And again, the statute envisions that an invitation need not be expressed. It may be implied. In terms of licensees and why the argument is, why doesn't a licensee enjoy the same duty of care as a trespasser? Let me make a small correction. The licensee doesn't enjoy the same duty of care as some trespassers, invited, constructively trespassers. The licensee will enjoy better duty of care than many, many trespassers.
Well, you got us in a swamp here now, so what duty of care are you arguing for?
In terms of that would be applied to...
Applied to this under 14-year-old child.
Well, first of all, this child, the duty of care that should be applied to this child is the duty of care of a licensee under the statute. He was not a trespasser. He was not induced to come onto this property by the alleged... attractive.
Yet if the thing is attractive enough under the common law, that person was an invitee entitled to the highest standard of care.
If they were actually attracted onto the property by the instrumentality that is the attractive nuisance.
Well, okay, so would you agree that your client is a landowner within the definition of the statute as set forth in Pearson?
Yes, that's been conceded.
Okay, and then would you agree that this is a tribal issue of fact as to whether or not this is an attractive nuisance?
No, I would not.
Why not?
Because it's undisputed that the little boy did not come onto the property as a result of the bungee run.
It was this event that included that.
He didn't know that, and that was never shown. I mean,
I'm not getting that.
Well,
has this case tried?
I'm sorry?
Has this case been tried?
No, sir, it hasn't.
Okay, well, so why isn't it a tribal issue?
Well,
whether this event was bandied about, all this fun stuff, including suspending yourself by a cord and running around and jumping and so on. I mean, you know, I don't get how you haven't placed yourself in the gate and us in the Gallegos problem with your construction here.
Well, the element...
You're arguing for a different standard of care, right?
No, I'm arguing for the standard of care of a licensee under the statute. That's what this young man is.
No, but you've got a generic provision here that's put here in a sort of a preamble to these three status categories that refers apparently to all children under 14. Right?
Well, what?
And before that is only, and then this comes on as if it's an exception to only. Right? I mean, you just took us through this reading of this thing.
And I guess I disagree with that characterization respectfully. It's not an exception to only.
Well, we're supposed to get at the General Assembly's intent here. And the question really boils down to whether or not we're going to protect all 14-year-olds with regard to an attractive nuisance that a jury or the judge acting, you know, trying the case without a jury, if that happens, can apply equally to everybody that fits in that 14-year-old and under category.
Well, I guess
you're trying to parse the 14-year-olds here without letting the jury decide whether or not this is an attractive nuisance. That's a question. I mean, it's not a statement. It's a question. Get us back out of the morass I think you've created.
Well, I think we get out of the morass by saying that the doctrine only applies to trespassing situations. That was clear at Colorado County Law. And so when we have the statute, the PLA, initially in 86 and 90, enacted and uses this phrase, abrogate the doctrine of attractive nuisance, what does attractive nuisance mean? It means it's a doctrine that only operates as an exception for certain trespassers. The young man's not a trespasser. he wasn't drawn onto the property by the attractive nuisance. And if that did happen, then we would treat him as an invitee, and we would apply the third and highest standard of care under the statute as an invitee. But the...
So if he came because of this bungee jumping event, he'd be an invitee?
I think if he trespassed because he walked by and saw that bungee run, and assuming a bungee run meets the qualifications...
But you just told us the common law treated these children as invitees because of the attractive...
Because of
mechanism.
Because of the thing that they saw when they walked by and said, my God, I can't, what is that thing? And they don't have the requisite judgment to be able to say, maybe that's a danger. One of the bases in the common law, and it's in cases that we cited that talk about why a licensee, for example, and a child licensee, for example, doesn't get that standard of care is, when a child's trespassing, there's this idea that a child's alone with other children. This case, we have a licensee who is actually with somebody, an adult, who's watching them. And that was noted in the facts of our case. And so there's discussion in these cases that talk about, well, if there's an adult present, the adult sees the merry-go-round. It's an example I want to keep coming back to. And an adult sees that that could be a fun thing, but the adult also knows that's a potentially dangerous piece of machinery. And they can be the judge for the child as to whether they want to let the child on, whether they want to let the child on unaccompanied, etc. And so there is a basis to distinguish between why we give the standard of care licensees, a particular standard of care, in only certain situations do we take that trespassing child and give them a higher standard of care. In effect, they are invitees. I hope that addresses the question. I'm happy to keep trying to answer it, but I hope that addresses it.
Mr. Palmer, maybe I come at it from a different point. Is invitee has the highest standard, licensee lesser standard, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And are you conceding that SW is a licensee?
The court found he was as such, and that was never disputed.
Okay.
So yes.
So how do you address the Gallegos problem that if a young man that morning had trespassed on and went on there and he was injured in the exact same fashion, his standard, the Gallegos problem, is that he would be considered to be an invitee and have a higher standard?
Mm-hmm. I think Gallegos is not a problem at all.
Okay, tell me why.
Because in Gallegos was interpreting the 1986 version of the statute, and Gallegos explained this in detail, what was trying to be achieved by the enactment of the 1986 version of the statute. And in Gallegos, this court talked about the legislative history and talked about what the goal of the statute was. And in fact, references one of the legislative debates, which I reviewed, and they actually talk about trespassing children being the applicable standard for attractive nuisance. But in any event, the goal was to return not only to a duty by status approach in Colorado, to get the law back to what it had been before 1971 in the Mile High case, it was also to return it back exactly the way it had been under Colorado common law. And that's noted in Gallegos. The problem with the 1986 version of the statute was that the definitions of invitee and licensee could, under certain factual situations, result in the licensee getting a more favorable standard of care than an invitee. And that was contrary to the way that Colorado common law had been. So this court said, look, if you tell us what you want to do is go back to the way Colorado common law exactly was in terms of liability, you didn't do that. You have a situation where we kind of have this inverted hierarchy of a licensee potentially being higher than an invitee. And there's no logical or historical reason for that. And those were the words that were used. There was no logical or historical basis for that. Now, let's talk about attractive nuisance again. There is a logical and historical basis for treating certain trespassers as invitees and giving them a higher duty of care, and it's for the reasons that we've already discussed. In certain situations, this irresistible artificial object operates as an express or constructive invitation to a child, drawing them irresistibly onto the property. So even though they technically are a trespasser, they have effectively been invited, and now they are an invitee, and we see that in case after case. So Gallegos is a problem. If we're talking about the rational basis test from Gallegos, which says, show me rationally why we would treat it this way, show me historically. In attractive nuisance, rationally and historically, we did treat it that way. that in some situations we would elevate the status of the trespasser.
So you're saying there's a rational basis to treat the invitee trespasser in, with a higher standard than the licensee?
There's a rational basis for taking certain trespassing children and recognizing that they are constructive invitees. And so they're not, we don't treat them as trespassers. They're not trespassers as a matter of law.
What's the rational basis between just an invitee child as opposed to a constructive invitee who is a trespasser? What's the rational basis for that?
Well, if we're talking about
that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about this case, just the example that Justice Boatwright gave you.
Do you mean a licensee child? Because if we're talking about an invitee child, I see no distinct, I mean, an invitee child already has the highest standard of care. If we're talking about a licensee child, a child that has consent to be on
yes,
the property.
Yes, you're right. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, again, I think it goes back to some of the language in some of the cases that are cited in the briefs that with that consent, that permissive consent of a licensee, there may be, say, a parent around to monitor the situation. And in fact, there was that in this case. So I think there is a rational basis and there was a historical basis for it. We see it again and again, again and again in the cases. Another factor, to get back to Justice Brodbright's question about why Gallegos is not a problem, the 1990 version of the statute corrected the Gallegos concerns and said, okay, we're not going back exactly the way things were, but we are going back to a system of designation of plaintiffs by classification, and we want liability to be keyed in to that classification. In the argument by the petitioners, there is no liability by classification. It doesn't matter why the little boy's on the property, whether he's a trespasser, licensee, or invitee. We simply apply this reasonable standard of care, whether that be the invitee standard or some fourth standard that's outside the statute, and there's no consideration given for the classification of the plaintiff. What we further know about the enactment of the 86 and 90 versions of the statute, and everything about those statutes was to narrow the circumstances in which a landowner could be liable. It was about restriction. It was about protecting landowners more than what they would get at common law. And in fact, that's expressed in the 1990 version of the statute. So we have this very anomalous situation here where we know everything about what the intent was of the statute, both when it was initially enacted and later reenacted. All about protecting landowners more, all about restrictions on liability, all about keying in to the classification of the plaintiff. And yet, for this one doctrine, attractive nuisance, which isn't even defined in the statute, we say none of that means anything with regard to that doctrine. That doctrine is wide open. That doctrine doesn't matter why the plaintiff.
Well, you want to freeze the common law to a particular designation you give them, but the common law is adaptable. If this refers to the common law, the doctrine of attractive and nuisance, why can't it be used, why can't we use it in a more modern setting recognizing
Are you
the
asking?
Policy? You're trying to freeze the doctrine into only trespassers.
Yes, I am.
It refers to the doctrine of attractive nuisance as recognized by the common law, and then it's applied to people under 14. First of all, common law was up to 18, so the legislature's doing something there. And then it refers to the common law. So do we or do we not have the authority to construe what the common law is regarding attractive nuisance in this state under this statute, this provision?
In other words, do you have the ability to modify the attractive nuisance doctrine as you deem
to
necessary?
To recognize what the common law would provide regarding attractive nuisance.
If you're
the common law is an adaptable, flexible.
Absolutely.
You know, we take into account developments in the common law. So
Absolutely. You're
asking for a frozen in time
yes, I am.
Common law.
Absolutely.
And
that's exactly
and your support that the legislature intended that?
Well, because of the language in the statute, number one, saying that we want more protection than was given in common law. If we're going to say that the doctrine is now, can be evolved by this court, is malleable, flexible, why can't you change it in such ways that would swallow entire portions of the statute? For example, can you interpret the
doctrine? We're construing a specific provision here where they specifically identified some exception to what they just said that affects the standard of care.
Okay. I was sticking to attractive nuisance, and let me stick to it. Attractive nuisance, reasonable care standard. Why can't you decide that the standard for attractive nuisance will now be strict liability? Because the welfare of children and the safety of children is so important that we are going to say now you will be strictly liable. Why can't you also say that we're not going to apply it to merely artificial objects like a merry-go-round? We're going to apply it to natural objects, your pond, a stream, the apple tree in your front yard. That could conceivably lure a child on your property. And if the protection of children is worth it, why don't we modify the doctrine and do that? Here's the problem with that. How is that less restrictive? How does that provide more protection to landowners, which is what the legislature wanted? They didn't want expansiveness in the premises liability law, and they especially did not what they viewed as inequitable and unpredictable results, and that is discussed in Gallegos, that was one of the problems they had with the regime that prevailed from 1971 up until the enactment of the 86 statute, that using a reasonable care analysis simply based on the circumstances and the concept of foreseeability didn't help predict what a landowner should or should not do. If I have the very first case that comes before this court where I plant an apple tree in my front yard, and this court decides that we're going to change the doctrine now and you're liable, Mr. Defendant, because your apple tree lured those kids onto the property, and even though it was a natural object, we're going to say it's a attractive nuisance, and this is so important, now you're subject to strict liability. How can I predict that? And is that equitable? And so you ask me if it's frozen in time. I say it is. It's frozen in time the way that this court had interpreted it up to that point. Because that is what fits all the goals expressed in section 1.5 of the statute. That is what fits the expressions in subsection 3, that a landowner will be liable in any action only as provided in the three-tiered designation in subsection 3. To do anything else, I think, defeats the overall purpose of the legislature. And that purpose of the legislature was to create predictability, to create duty by status, to create equity, to create more protection for landowners, to create the affordability of insurance. That should be a consideration if we're gonna change the law or have the ability to change the law in such a fashion that we could say nearly any object to be an attractive nuisance. And we're gonna have a very burdensome standard of care, such as strict liability. And that would be my response to you. And I'm happy to continue to address that, but that's what I see as the problem.
Thanks for your response.
Thank you. I wish to address a couple more points that were made by opposing counsel. There's reference to very early cases in Colorado, namely the Petty and Sherman cases, and there was a characterization that these are attractive nuisance cases. As we noted in our brief, they're not attractive nuisance cases. The Sherman case, the Petty case, which was, I believe, the earlier case, involved a involved a washing machine. And this is from 1924. So you can imagine it's a washing machine with lots of moving parts. There's a store. Mothers would come into the store to pay certain utility bills. They would have their children in tow. And unfortunately, a toddler in that instance wandered away from his mother, and stuck his hand in the washing machine, and the hand was mangled. Now, the defendant in that case said, well, really the problem here is the mother was inattentive. There's no proximate cause against us. We don't know any duty to that little boy. And this court said, wait a minute. There's this turntable doctrine out there. And even if that little boy had been a trespasser, you might owe a duty of care. So don't stand here in front of us and tell me that you didn't owe a duty of care and that there's no question about proximate cause. So it wasn't an attractive nuisance claim. They were merely taking that turntable doctrine, noting that it exists, and saying, look, if there could be a duty of care even under a turntable doctrine for a trespasser, this young man's on the property with permission, so you might owe a duty of care and you may be liable. The same thing happened in the Sherman case. That was a case involving a 13-year-old boy who would, as we say, alight from trolley cars. He would jump up and down from moving trolley cars, and you can see the clear danger there. And the defendant in that matter, the trolley company, said, well, no, wait a minute. Yeah, he was on the train, on the trolley cars without permission, but honestly, what he was doing was obviously dangerous. He should have known that. And this court, in fact, said explicitly, had he been an adult, contributory negligence would have barred that claim outright. But he wasn't an adult. He was a 13-year-old boy. And the court then looked to the turntable doctrine and said, look, we have this doctrine out there. It's called the turntable doctrine. And part of its basis is that a child, in this case, a 13-year-old boy, doesn't have the requisite maturity, the requisite deliberation, life experience to necessarily know that what he's doing is incredibly dangerous. And so we're not going to say as a matter of law that in this circumstance, that person is barred from recovering based on contributory negligence. So those are not contributory attractive nuisance cases. I'm out of time. I would simply ask that the court affirm the ruling of the district of the appellate court below. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Purvis, rebuttal.
Your Honor, I have to confess, I don't have a clue how much time I've got.
You've got 1 minute and 55 seconds, and who's counting? 1 minute and 55 seconds.
1 minute and 55. I will do better than that. Let me just respond in terms of what the legislature intended. Rather than characterization of that, the best source I'd suggest is the statute itself. And it says in section 3.5 of the 1990 version, which is correcting what went bad in the earlier version, it is the intent of the General Assembly in enacting the provisions of this of subsection 3 of this section that the circumstances under which a licensee may recover include all of the circumstances under which a trespasser could recover, and that the circumstances under which an invitee may recover include all of the circumstances under which a trespasser or a licensee could recover. He said, that's the purpose. And then they go on, they said earlier in 1.5, mentioned by counsel, the purpose of amending this section in the 1990 legislative session is to assure that the language of this section effectuates these legitimate governmental interests which were being addressed by Gallegos versus Fitz. Effectuates these legitimate governmental interests by imposing on landowners a higher standard of care with respect to an invitee than a licensee, and a higher standard of care with respect to a licensee than a trespasser. So you can't avoid the fact that this scheme gives a preference to the and greater protections to the trespassing child, whether the licensee or the invitee, is both contrary to the express stated purposes in the statute, contrary to the plain language of the statute, and contrary to Gallegos versus Phipps. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to thank both attorneys for your arguments. The case will be submitted.